Welcome to All Sides with Anna Staver. Do you need special skills to do something extraordinary? Or do you just need passion? A drive to keep going when others would have stopped? We're talking this hour about the kind of passion that motivates a mom to rebrand her successful bakery as gluten-free. The motivation to play an opponent during a political debate prep. Or the drive to make your career selling peanuts. Our first guest has done the latter. Brian Ginta is the owner of the Crema Nut Company on Goodell Boulevard in Grandview. The company has been roasting small batches of peanuts by hand since the 1800s, and Brian has been a part of it since 1991.
Indeed.
Brian, welcome to All Sides.
Thank you.
Your parents bought Crema when you were a kid. Do you remember what your initial reaction was to being in the peanut butter business?
It sounded awesome. We had always had that product around the house. And so thinking about them purchasing the company to make it, I was in the eighth grade. So I kind of don't think I fully understood what was going on other than we were about to make a lot of delicious food.
You started working there as a teen.
I did.
What kept you in the business? Because, you know, a lot of people don't stay in the family business that way.
It was so neat. There's not another company that's really truly like it. And when you think about the way we kind of do it and the joy that you see, because I had started at the bottom washing everything you could think of and had seen all parts of the business. And the retail store is one of my favorites because you see the joy and the different special occasions that everybody is purchasing something for and how excited they are to have it.
Was there a moment when you realized, I want to make this my business?
In college, I was trying to figure out exactly what direction I wanted to go. And it was right around 2000, and that was kind of the start of the internet. And so I'm looking at this, you know, 100-plus-year-old company saying, what new can we do? And so e-commerce was just starting. So I created our first website, and that's kind of really what drew me in and to be able to kind of show pictures and neat things to the world, really, of what the great things that we had to offer that we make. So that really kind of started that major career path for me.
And growing that online business.
Indeed, which has become a significant portion.
Yeah, Crema started back in 1898.
Correct.
That's 50 years before Jif came along. Yeah, it came along. I Googled it. It came along in the 1940s.
Nice.
So what's the secret behind the company's longevity? Because it's one of the oldest makers of peanut butter in the United States.
Continuously working, that's correct. So for us, our commitment to freshness and top quality. So I'll get calls all the time from other folks saying, hey, I've got a bargain on, you know, X number of pallets of nuts. And, you know, we buy from the same farms, from the same great folks that share the same high quality values we do. And then we make every 7 days. I always talk about it's like Groundhog's Day, where, you know, once a week we'll oil roast all of our nuts. We'll make peanut butter once a week. So our goal is to have everything that you were to come in the store and take off the shelf, you know, be no more than 7 or so days old.
Which is a lot fresher than you probably find in the grocery store.
Unfortunately, it definitely is. By the time all those products kind of just travel through their distribution centers, we go right from the back right up to the retail store.
And it's all roasted here in Ohio.
It is, right on Grandview, right in Grandview.
Can you tour the roasting facility, or how much access does public get to those kinds
of? So they kind of some rules change with food facilities. So we have, when you walk in the retail store, we have three great big bay windows that you can overlook the factory floor. And so as soon as you look in, you see the roasting area. Jay does a fantastic job roasting all of our nuts. It's a batch roaster, 150 pounds at a time, which may sound like a lot. It's not in our world. And then you look further down and you've got where we bag everything up fresh, just as what we need. So it's always, everything's cruising well. And then you look way in the back and you see the dry roasting area for the peanut butter, as well as our peanut butter making machines and been putting together the peanut butter.
How many pounds of nuts do you go through in a year?
I guess that depends on the nut. It's a few hundred thousand pounds.
Oh my goodness.
Probably total. So
that's a lot of nuts.
Our busiest time is Christmas, folks.
That makes sense.
Holiday season, I should say.
And you have a variety of sandwiches and peanut butter flavors and milkshakes that you can all get at the store. I want to ask though, I love peanut butter. It's one of my favorite foods, but a peanut butter and pickle sandwich. I don't don't know about this one.
You know, it's so funny. That's actually my favorite sandwich.
Oh, my goodness.
So there's a place called the Crazy Cucumber. Katie Varga does this great job making these local pickles. So we get those. And I remember my wife and I first tried the sandwich, and I looked at it. I said, I'm not eating that. And
see, that's like, my reaction.
No, you got to try it. I'm like, all right, fine. I'll take one bite. And it was great. So we don't add any salt or sugar or hydrogenated oils to the peanut butter. It's just peanuts. So the saltiness from the pickles, they're come out of with the pickle juice. So they're, it's a little damp. But it all just works well with the crunch of the pickle and the kind of salty brine. It's fantastic.
I guess I'll have to try it. It sounds like a weird pregnancy craving to me.
I can see that.
I also looked up, you serve classic PB&Js. You also have peanut butter and bananas, Fluffernutters, which are all the things that you would expect to see. Can you tell me about the orange sickle?
The orange sickle is great. So we get an orange apricot marmalade from a place called Sarah Beth out of New York. And Sarah Beth is a wonderful person who has grown significantly over the last few years. And so you've got the piece of the orange and of all the fruits in there, and it makes a fantastic topping that has like a nice little tangy zest, again with that natural peanut butter, so it's not overly sweet, which is what we want. And if you did want something sweet, then you can go to the Fluffernutter or the Buckeye, which has Nutella.
Very traditional Fluffernutter. Also, peanut butter and banana is a pretty solid combo, but you have a hot peanut butter and banana sandwich.
Indeed. So Mike's Hot Honey has really gained a lot of steam lately. And so we've got our PB Nana that is toasted with either creamy or crunchy, and then we slice fresh bananas on top. And then that Mike's Hot Honey gives it a nice zing. So even if you don't like spicy food, it's just enough of a little kind of how you doing to make it delicious but not burn you up.
You also have spicy peanut butter. I got to ask, how hot is the spicy peanut butter?
It's like a medium. So it's enough where you kind of eat it and it sneaks up on you where it gives you a little burn at the end. And so it's kind of a coarser grind, not a fine grind like the creamy and not a coarse like the crunchy. And so it's a nice kind of textured peanut butter that'll give you a little zap.
Yeah, you also have a spicy peanut butter and jelly milkshake, which I'm also not sure about.
You know, it's funny because the ice cream and the heat work surprisingly well. That was another one that I looked at and said, maybe I don't want to try this. And actually, it was awesome because it kind of get a little warm with the sweetness and the cool and the sweetness of the ice cream. It's pretty snazzy.
Do you have like tasting flights? Can you get like little mini samples of each?
You know, it's funny. We should. The peanut butter is always available for trying. We have our little kitchen where it's all open. That would be delicious.
Have you ever tried a combination that you didn't like? Like, do you guys experiment in the back and then we're like, nope?
You know, we have. We always try to come up with newer products and new mixes and new flavorings and a lot of stuff. Probably 85% of what we try doesn't make it to the factory floor. To the retail floor. It's always fun trying. There's always something I'll be wandering around and buy and say, you know what that should be good with, and kind of shake it up and try it. So we do a lot of R&D, which is a lot of fun, but also stressful because you want to make sure you come up with the awesome product that folks are just going to love.
And peanut butter and pickles made the cut.
Peanut butter and pickles made the cut.
I'll have to give it a try. It just, something instinctively is like, no, that's not going to go together.
It is delicious. It's definitely worth a try.
You also have expanded into chocolate making.
We do. We started that a long time ago where we have a whole different part of the company that you can't see because chocolate needs very sensitive temperatures. So it's got to be a specific temperature. The machines are specific temperatures. So it's in a real climate controlled room. But we have our pecan turtles and cashew claws, and it's caramel with the nuts covered in chocolate, along with the patties where it's nuts kind of laid out into a disc. It's all very hands-on, so fantastic patties and some other chocolate goodies, sea salt, dark chocolate, sea salt caramels, chocolate peanuts, chocolate almonds, the good staples as well.
And I understand you take a lot of extra effort to make sure they don't melt when you ship them.
Yeah, so right now I don't like winter. I love summer. So for us, but chocolate doesn't love winter. So we have a great little cold pack set up because, like we talked about earlier, we do a lot of shipping. So to make sure we get it right to your door in its perfect condition, we have a great little cold pack set up. It's funny, whenever we have customers that either send a gift or want to take something home, it's kind of like, hey, so you're going right home after this, right? And if the answer is no, it's like, well, don't forget about the chocolate. And they say, thank you, I'll bring it in with me or something to that effect. Just melted chocolate. If you close your eyes and eat it, it tastes exactly the same. But visually, it's a bit of a mess.
You know what I love? people listening to this who aren't listening on the Ohio channel can't see you. You've been doing nothing but smiling for the last like 10, 15 minutes. And I just love, you seem so genuinely passionate about peanut butter.
It's so cool because, you know, you just don't see, you know, we're kind of foodies at the house and in the family, and you don't see kind of the way that we do it. And I want to do it exact opposite of the way everybody else does it, because nothing good is easy. And so, you know, come in the retail store and our training, always the first thing is, you know, to greet the customer and, you know, if they need help find anything or want to taste something, to make sure everybody has a top experience, and making the best stuff. I'll get samples of nuts from other farms, and I don't know what our farms do to it that's different, or they talk to the trees or whatnot, but they do such a great job. So those are the folks we want to partner with to just offer just the best stuff.
Yeah, and you also partner with a lot of local businesses or regional businesses, which I also think is really neat.
It's great. We've partnered with Johnson's. So Matt is the third generation owner of Johnson's, and I'm the second generation for the current ownership from my parents. And so kind of the kids and family business have this special bond where a lot of folks, you've kind of got to be there to understand it. So we met through our dads in about 1999 or 2000. And have been fantastic friends, and great to chat
business. And now you're working together.
Indeed. So we sell them peanut butter that they use on their sundaes and whatnot. And then for our ice cream, for our milkshakes, we use the Johnson's vanilla ice cream, and then the novelties and whatnot we also offer. And they do a great job over there.
So your store isn't super large, and you guys don't do a lot of grocery store sales anymore, correct?
That's correct. No more. Our goal is to kind of, in keeping over that freshness, we want you to come to Goodale or want it to just go UPS right to whoever it's supposed to go to, because you really kind of lose control when it really leaves your site. So we'll do a little bit of various stores, but nothing, no big box.
That was a little bit of a risk, right? To say I'm going to pull out of the grocery store. Like most small businesses are trying to push into the grocery store.
Very true. We do everything kind of differently. It's a real unique product, real unique customer. Our pricing, I think, is very fair, especially for what you're getting. And our commitment to freshness and just making sure everything is just amazing is really what keeps us going and wanting to keep kind of, I don't want to say control, but to really keep control over the product.
So Cremonaut's been around since 1898. What do you see when you look at the company's future? Where do you want it to be in 2098 for its bicentennial?
Well, I plan on being here for that. And
so do I.
I love it. So I think, you know, Goodale has changed so much with the yard. You know, the Big Bear warehouses years ago, which was a grocery store here in town, the main grocery store, when they went out of business, whatever happened, they closed and left. And, it definitely was a little bit of a sting to Grandview. And then when Nationwide Realty came in and changed the entire street, it was magnificent. So now then you've got, from old commercial buildings, now you've got all these residences and apartments and restaurants, and it's the cool place to be, which 30 years ago, I would not have bet any money on that. And so I think our headquarters in Grandview continues to be the key to the success. And having the next generation say, I remember when my grandmother took me here, my mother, my relative, my whatever. And that's so cool to see kind of the older generation say, I remember when my grandmother took me here. And you just look and say, gosh, I wish I could see through your mind of memories to see what everything was like. But I think our future, between mail order, direct consumer, a lot of gifts in the fourth quarter, because there's only so big you can get as well without kind of changing the way we do it. And the way we do it is, I think,
the best. It's the whole thing.
I want to keep it that way.
That was Brian Ginda, the owner of the Cremonaut Company on Goodale Boulevard in Grandview. Thank you so much for joining me this morning.
Thanks for having me.
Coming up, how parental love led a Delaware mom to rebrand her successful bakery as gluten-free. That's when All Sides continues on 89.7 NPR News.
The cat sat on the mat. I'm Rachel Martin. You probably know how interview podcasts with famous people usually go. There's a host, a guest, and a light Q&A. But on Wildcard, we have ripped up the typical script. It's a new podcast from NPR where I invite actors, artists, and comedians to play a game using a special deck of cards to talk about some of life's biggest questions. Listen to Wildcard wherever you get your podcasts, only from NPR.
You're listening to All Sides. I'm your host, Anna Staver. Opening a bakery isn't easy. 60% of new food businesses fail in the first 3 years. The Dip Donut in Delaware was a success story. Their donut shop was thriving, which is why their loyal customers were a little surprised when the owners announced that Dip would be closing, rebranding as an entirely gluten-free operation. Jenny Rita is the owner of the Dip Donut in Delaware, and she joins me now to explain why. Welcome to All Sides, Jenny.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
It's quite a decision to shutter a successful business. Can you share how you came to that decision?
It was very easy. We decided that anyone can go to any city in any town and grab a donut. People that are deprived of wheat products, they need us right now. They can't go anywhere for a donut, and we are providing joy and happiness to those people.
And this is a really personal decision.
It is a personal decision. My daughter was diagnosed with celiac in 2008, and at that time it was devastating. It really was. There were not many food options, and I told her at that time, I said, Kayla, I believe that God's going to use us for good. I had absolutely no idea that I was going to end up in the gluten-free space at all. So
you guys were in the laundry space at that point, right?
I've been in the laundromat industry for 25 years. So the Dip Donut came about because I wanted to do something fun. Being in the laundry industry is not fun. People are not excited to be there. So that's how we came up with the Dip Donut. And we've always ran gluten-free donuts, but it was just once a month when we were close to the public.
Yeah, the Dip Donut, for those who have never been, and you have another month to go if mm-hmm. you've never ever mm-hmm. been, they have all of the different like sauces and toppings, and basically they build it right there in
yes.
front of you.
Yes, food entertainment is what it is, yes. And it's the donuts are delicious, and I am going to be very, very sad. I mean, it is a very, it's a very wonderful business, and a lot of people come there for first day of school, last day of school, celebrations.
Birthday parties.
We do a lot of weddings. Actually, our last event is on the 27th of July. That's why we picked that date. So it's going to be sad. And if it does not sell, if the business does not sell, we will do something with it later on, just not right now. We're so busy in the gluten-free store that I just need the space. And I own the building, so it only makes sense for us to do the expansion there.
Yeah, the Dipped Donuts gluten-free store is actually right next door to the
Dipped
Donut.
It is. It is a separate facility, separate rooftop unit. It's a dedicated space. So we're a certified facility where people can walk in our door and everything in there is certified and they are safe to pick out whatever they want to eat.
So there's no thinking about it. There's no fear of cross-contamination.
Absolutely not. When people walk through our door, the joy that you see immediately is just, it just lights you up. And you can tell if someone walks in, it's their first time, you can tell that it's their first time. And it's wonderful.
And your customers are coming from crazy far away.
Yes, yes. I mean, I had an employee document 16 pages. I have people driving. This lady drove 13 hours, Iowa, 9 hours. I can't even give you an estimate because it's all over the board. I mean, 5 hours, 4 hours. 3.5 hours. They're coming from everywhere because people want and deserve good quality gluten-free food, and it is hard to get.
Yeah, and I will say, at least in the comments online and from my own personal experience, it is pretty hard to tell the difference between your two varieties of donuts.
Yeah, you can't. It's pretty close. What we do is,
which is not always the case with gluten-free options.
It is not. It's typically dry. That is a warning that I give a new mom that has a celiac diagnosis for their child is the food can be dry. What we do at our store that makes us different from anyone else, it has to mimic gluten. If it does not mimic its wheat counterpart, we do not make it. So
How long did you spend perfecting that recipe?
A long time. And I work with a food scientist. So
oh, wow.
That is a very, very expensive piece of what we do.
I didn't even realize that.
Yes. So we work with a food scientist because if we use a specific ingredient, it may not work well with our flour blend or something else or the milk that we use. So it has to be perfect. So for instance, like our gluten-free, dairy-free yeast donuts, that took us probably about 9 or 10 tries to get that perfected.
Are you going to be doing any of your like cinnamon buns or any of the other things that you make at the bakery?
We do cinnamon rolls in the gluten-free store. So we bake them, and then we also have a product where you can bake them at home. So it's a take-and-bake cinnamon roll, yes. So we do gluten-free, and then we also cater to the gluten-free, dairy-free market as well.
Oh, so you even have vegan donuts.
Well, we do not have vegan. Okay. We use egg.
Oh, that's
so
true.
So we do use egg. And while I am only a gluten-free store, we have probably about 40% of our customer base needs to be dairy-free as well.
Oh.
So all of our donuts are dairy-free. We do have cinnamon rolls that are dairy-free as well. And then like a lot of our products, like our Pop-Tarts that we make in-house are dairy-free. And even our pizza products, some of those are dairy-free as well.
Oh my goodness. You have gluten-free Pop-Tarts.
Yes, we sell a lot of those, a ton.
Yeah, because I would think that's one of those things that is so nostalgic.
Yes. And so I do a survey. I don't want to just bake cupcakes. I want to do things that people actually miss. Number one most missed thing was a yeast donut because there's no one that makes it. There's absolutely no one that makes it.
Yeah, that's fascinating. So you have Pop-Tarts, cinnamon rolls, donuts. What other gluten-free products are on the horizon for you?
We literally do everything. So we have hamburger hot dog buns. We make macaroni and cheese. We do General Tso's chicken. We do buffalo chicken. We do literally everything.
Oh my goodness. You're like a one-stop shop for gluten-free eating.
We have everything that you need. We are a retail operation, so people do their grocery shopping with us.
Oh my goodness.
Yeah. So instead of going to, here's what it's like in the life of a celiac.
Mm-hmm.
You might have to run to Whole Foods. They may not have what you need. You might be looking for a fish product, a chicken product, a noodle. They may not have what you need. So you have to run to another store. They might not have what you need. So you have to go to a third store, Trader Joe's, here and there. I try to have everything. While the products that I have in my store, I may not consume those or our family may not. That's what people are wanting. So,
yeah, it's a lot of label reading if you have any kind of dietary restriction.
It absolutely is. You are a planner and you are a label reader. And it's hard.
Yeah, because sometimes my brother is vegan, and so a lot of dairy-free cheese is still made with casein, which is a milk protein. So there's like so much crazy label reading that you don't think about
sure.
if you eat a certain way.
Yes. And one other thing that I would like to highlight is I am doing this expansion in this business for one reason. My husband and I, we've been in the laundromat industry for a long, long time. We own the building that we're in. We're building our children's homes. We just finished my daughter, and we're building our son's home right now. But what I'm so passionate about is not leaving any child behind, okay? So I'll give you an example of that. I got a message the day before school was out, or maybe 2 days before, and the middle school was having Long John's from Snyder's Bakery. Love Snyder's Bakery. There were three celiacs that would not be able to participate in that breakfast. Mm. So the mom reached out and said, is there any possible way? Well, we don't do yeast donuts on the day that she reached out. And I thought to myself, that's why I'm doing what I'm doing. We need to do the donuts for those three kids. And I don't want those three kids to be left out. So it's very, very, very important to me because I remember what it was like for my daughter growing up. And I know what it's like right now to have a dietary restriction because everything that we do from birth to death revolves around food. Every celebration, every birthday, literally everything that we do revolves around food. And if you don't have food to eat and you feel left out or you get something that looks very different, it's not fun. It really isn't. So.
Yeah, no, I think that's really great.
Mm-hmm.
Because it's not something you think about unless you are that person. And in some ways, it's gotten a lot easier. There's a lot more gluten-free options. But in some ways, I think it's gotten harder because I wonder if restaurants and other places take it less seriously because so many people are doing it who aren't celiac.
Yeah, there are people that come in that don't need to be gluten-free that choose that diet. And that's fine.
Oh, yeah.
We don't mind. And
no.
We have people that come in and get Long John's because they don't want to drive to Snyder's or Columbus to get Long John's, and that's fine too. You can't tell that they're gluten-free, but I just want to fill the little niche, and we are literally changing people's lives. I get gifts in the mail, which I'm pleased do not send me anything. thank you cards from moms, a fill-in, you know, at a birthday party because a mom was just so grateful that we were able to step in and provide a cupcake, provide a pizza for her son for a birthday party. Just little thank yous. And I know for me personally, I shared this story a while back. I wanted to send a message to a restaurant that I received great service at, and it slipped in my mind. I ran out of time. But my customers, they always send me messages, and I'm like, these people are taking a lot of time out to thank me. Like, they're counting on me. They need me. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So it's super cool in that way. So, and my staff, they are a wonderful extension of me. They have the same passion. I mean, they don't honestly know what it's like to have a child with a dietary restriction, but they know me well enough, and they are a very great extension of me. And they're the ones behind the scene that are doing the work. They really are.
I understand that when you first started offering gluten-free options on your website, it crashed?
It did. And we still have trouble with that right now. So we got dumped with 111. We just started shipping 111 orders. We had to shut it off. We literally, I know right now, we are not going to be able to keep up with the demand that we are envisioning right now. And that is fine. We will. I don't want our people to be stressed out. I don't want to be stressed out. We'll do the very best that we can to get our products in the people's hands. And I do not have any plans for future expansions outside of my store. I do not have any.
It's your new place is called Gluten Free from the Dipped, correct?
That is accurate. Right now, we're going through a rebranding process. So we have an outside company that will help name us and give us a new mission statement so that it can be just dedicated to the gluten-free community.
And for those wondering, it's at 256 South Sandusky Street up in Delaware.
That's accurate, yes.
But you're open, you're not open in the afternoons and evenings, right?
That is a Dip Donut.
Oh, okay.
So the gluten-free facility is open from 7 a.m. to 8 p.m. every day of the year. We do close 2 days for Christmas and 2 days for Thanksgiving. Other than that, they have access to the store at any time.
But if someone wants to try the regular donuts before you close, I think it closes at like 3.
It closes at noon.
Ah.
So we are closed Sunday and Monday, and we're open Tuesday through Friday from 6:30 to noon and Saturday from 7 to noon.
And again, it's 256 South Sandusky Street in Delaware. If anyone is curious, you can also find them online. You have a Dip Donut Facebook page, and you also now have a gluten-free from the Dipped Facebook page.
We do. Yes, we do.
That'll probably be the best way to stay up on the new store and the rebrand and what's going on.
That's accurate, yes.
So as a practical matter, I'm just wondering if you can offer any, like, don't give away your recipes or your secrets, but for anyone listening who's like, how do you do it without gluten? Are there any advice or tips that you have?
It's literally a science project. It literally is. So everything that we do uses a different flour blend. So what we use for our yeast donuts is not the same flour that we use for our Pop-Tarts. It depends on the end product. So start with the end product and then you go backwards. So
it's a lot of trial and error then.
It is. And one thing that I've been struggling with and is I feel like I do not want to get into the franchise space, but I feel like I would love to share my yeast donut recipe, at least my flour blend, with other bakeries across the United States, because I don't feel like I should keep that to myself.
Mm.
I feel like other states should be able to produce a gluten-free, dairy-free yeast donut. I mean, people that can't have a Long John and to be able to have that reaction, I mean, people have memories. You know, maybe their grandfather took them to the bakery when they were younger. I have people that come in and they will take the product out of the facility and come back and they will say, are you sure this is gluten-free? And I say, yes, I'm positive. I might have someone that will send me a text message and say, if you see someone on your security camera outside crying in their car, that was me. I used to get donuts with my grandmother. So it is just, it's literally filling a void that people have, you know, a memory. So
donuts in particular are such a nostalgic thing.
I know. And everyone loves donuts. Pretty much everyone loves donuts.
That's true.
Yeah.
And it's one of those things you remember going to. You're right. I can remember going with my grandmother. I take my girls and we even make them at home sometimes.
Yes, it's just fun. It's just a fun memory.
Yeah, I think. And then now you get to share it with a whole new host and a whole new group of people.
And it's absolutely wonderful because those people have been told no pretty much since they were diagnosed. I mean,
right,
they've been told no.
And there's varying degrees of celiacs. So some people get very bad stomach upset. For other people, it can be much more serious.
Yes, I have some customers, they end up in the hospital. And it could be literally a crumb. So if someone puts a crouton on their salad and they remove it and they get contaminated just from that, they can end up in the hospital. While my daughter, she is about 4 or 5 days that she's down. And it's debilitating. And it causes a lot of anxiety.
Oh,
so
I bet.
People with celiac disease or autoimmune conditions that can't have wheat, there's a lot of anxiety because you're fearful if you're going to get sick or not.
Even in a place that offers gluten-free options.
If they offer gluten-free option and they have wheat in that facility, there can be a lot of anxiety. So that's another thing that I love about our operation is they come in and it's just like freedom.
There's not a grain of wheat in the building.
It is literally freedom for them. They can just, kids and adults alike, they just look around and they're like, oh my gosh. And some people, they had no idea. You know, a lady came in and she goes, you sell licorice? And I said, yeah, because it has wheat in it. She goes, I didn't know that. That's probably what's been making me sick.
Mm.
She was newly diagnosed. She didn't have any idea. So yeah, we see all kinds of people and I love talking to them. They're very grateful and I'm grateful for them. And I'm grateful that we are able to create a memory with them. And someone put it very well with me. I am not only changing their life, but I'm changing their relationship with food.
Mm.
So, and that's very important too, because we all need to eat and be happy at the same time.
And donuts are a good way to eat and be happy.
There you go.
That was Jenny Rita, owner of the Dip Donut in Delaware, soon to become a fully gluten-free facility. Follow them on Gluten-Free from the Dipped on Facebook. Thank you so much for your time this morning.
Thank you, Anna. It was nice being with you today.
Coming up, what's it really like getting ready for a big political debate? That's when All Sides with Anna Staver continues on 89.7 NPR News.
I'm Rachel Martin. You probably know how interview podcasts with famous people usually go. There's a host, a guest, and a light Q&A. But on Wildcard, we have ripped up the typical script. It's a new podcast from NPR where I invite actors, artists, and comedians to play a game using a special deck of cards to talk about some of life's biggest questions. Listen to Wildcard wherever you get your podcasts, only from NPR.
You're listening to All Sides. I'm your host, Anna Staver. Tonight is the first presidential debate of the 2024 election. And for years, I've wondered about the people who get candidates ready. Specifically, the people who play their opponent during debate prep. Who is playing Donald Trump for Joe Biden? Who played Barack Obama for Mitt Romney? How do you prepare to debate as somebody else? Do you dress up in character? I kind of hope that they do. Here to answer all these questions is Republican strategist Terry Casey. He pretended to be Ohio Senator Sherrod Brown for Josh Mandel, Governor Ted Strickland for John Kasich, and Richard Cordray for Governor Mike DeWine. Welcome to All Sides, Terry.
Glad to be here.
How does one become a political stand-in?
You kind of get asked, but part of it is it involves a lot of preparation on both sides. And I think that's one of the key things people don't realize. When the President of the United States, with all the issues of the world, spends the last 7 days at Camp David preparing, takes a lot of time. Trump prepares differently. He's got a different style. But however you do this, it takes a lot of time in informal Q&A, because whether you're running for governor, senator, or president, there's all kind of issues all over the place: health, economics, international, domestic policy, immigration, that you could be asked about. And you don't want to get a question and then say, oh, I don't have any idea. So it takes a lot of time to prepare.
And for you, you have to prepare for how the opponent might answer these questions.
Well, thank heavens these days for the internet, because you can do searches to see in various interviews what people such as former Governor Strickland or Rich Cordray or others would have said. And I might mention, in preparing, I also did Mary Jo Kilroy a few times for Steve Stivers, but I didn't dress with the skirt or lipstick. That would have been too shocking.
Did you dress up, though? Like, did you don a Sherrod Brown outfit?
Well, when you do this, if you're going to do it really formally, you do it in a setting that you're standing at a podium, you've got different people asking questions. A big part of the preparation for any debate is to get used to the timing.
Yeah.
Because in some debates in Ohio, you've had 90 seconds for your answer, and then 90 seconds for the other person, then a potential 60 seconds. This one's a little unusual tonight because each candidate's kind of got 2 minutes, so it's a longer segment. But most politicians on both sides are used to getting up and speaking. I mean, it's hard for a lot of politicians to say hello in 5 or 8 minutes, let alone get it down to 60 seconds or 90 seconds.
Yeah, it's hard for anybody. Being pithy, like extemporaneously pithy, is a definite skill set.
Well, and the other set, and it just gets into the strategy, if you've got 2 minutes to give an answer to the question, how much do you spend answering that question or dodging or diverting the question versus, and then I want to follow up on what was said earlier, blah, 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 and you do a retort, or do you use that to ask a question or poke on some other subject? So 2 minutes, good or bad, is a lot of time, and we'll see how the two candidates, whether they all try and use up all the 2 minutes, or whether they go off in different directions, or they just answer it in 15 or 20 seconds.
When you prepare to be the stand-in for the opponent, do you try to emulate their speaking style?
Well, somewhat. The key thing is you want to be prepared and understand what they're going to say and also what they're going to attack on. Because sometimes candidates focus in debates, and this is obviously not going to happen tonight, where you just kind of want to get through it and say as little and as minimum as possible. But when you're running for president, and when it's 90 minutes, because some debates in Ohio have been only 60 minutes, but when you've got 90 minutes with just 2 short breaks, that's a lot of time. And you've got to be prepared on all kind of things. But you want to get the feeling, because, again, the toughest thing is how to get used to answering or diverting on the question. And then do you clean up on something else that maybe you didn't get a chance to answer, because you might have answered first, the opponent said something and attacked you. There's something left open, and maybe you want to finish up and answer the attack from the opponent.
Yeah, I think that's... it's such an interesting idea of trying to prep for the way that somebody else might handle themselves in these situations. Do you also have to decide how aggressive you think their opponent is going to be?
Absolutely. That's one of the key things, because sometimes, example, when Mike DeWine prepared for the first debate in Dayton against Richard Cordray, Richard Cordray is viewed by some as a more intellectual, a little more laid-back kind of guy. But in that debate, he was very, very aggressive. Well, I'm glad in a number of the debate preps that I duplicated a little bit of the intensity of, because the candidate's got to be prepared. You know, at a news conference, or you're giving a speech, or you're doing a rally, it's you talking and nobody's going back and forth with you or attacking you. So part of it's getting used to taking incoming missiles and not letting it bother you, because on television, people look at body language. And if you're looking bothered or puzzled, and here's another little secret, when candidates get a question, they say, Thank you. That's a very good question.
Oh, people do that all the time. It's a delay tactic.
Absolutely, because you need the delay to think, okay, boy, that's a tough question. What am I going to say? So you do that kind of thing in order to kind of mark time to figure out what the heck am I going to respond, and do I answer the question or do I divert and go off on some other kind of stall tactic?
How you look is actually surprisingly important in these debates. The famous Nixon-Kennedy debate. I think that was one of the first televised presidential debates. Those who listened on the radio thought Nixon won. Those who saw it on TV thought Kennedy won.
Yes, but given your youthful age, and even Mike Thompson, your news director, said that was before he was born. So a lot of people weren't around then, because that was the days of black and white TV and hot studio lights. But how you look, how your body language, and also in history, there were some cases like George H.W. Bush in the debate. Twice he looked down at his watch as if he was bored and when's this going to be over? Those are the kind of things that tend to get replayed on the news segments, or the Michael Dukakis when he was asked by Bernard Shaw of CNN if his wife was raped and murdered. And he kind of gave the standard Massachusetts governor answer of how he's against the death penalty.
It was two automaton. It wasn't human.
Absolutely. So the body language is something everyone understands. That's part of the magic, good or bad, of television.
Yeah, the other thing is you want to be careful not to be so focused on your talking points that you get tripped up. Chris Christie famously took down Marco Rubio in the 2016 presidential debates when Marco got all tripped up and started repeating his talking points for the second go-around.
Or the other thing that's happened, like in the first Ronald Reagan debate, they had him overly prepared and too loaded up with all kind of factoids and information
things. And he kind of bombed that first one.
Absolutely, very much so, because you can over-prepare a candidate and you've got to keep a certain looseness, a certain relaxed nature, a certain confidence. And if you don't display that, that doesn't come across well to people sitting in their living room or at their kitchen table.
There's also been people who track how often you take a sip of water.
Absolutely. It's part of the nature, and it's even worse these days with social media and all the cable channels. Everybody's looking for any little faux pas, or if somebody closes their eyes for more than a blink, does that mean they're falling asleep?
This go around, though, there won't be a live audience and microphones will be muted while one of the candidates is speaking, which I find really interesting because that is something that traditionally I think you prepare for, what to do when your opponent interrupts.
Absolutely. And even though I don't know the microphones are going to have in that studio, but sometimes microphones can be shut off, but then the other microphone will still pick it up if you're saying something. But that is something you need to be prepared for if your opponent's going to interrupt you, heckle you, try and throw you off stride.
How do you teach somebody to reject the premise of a question? Because you see that a lot in debates. Like, if you don't like the question, just reject it.
Well, one of the things your news director said, because he's been a veteran doing lots and lots of debates, he tries to ask questions that only have one question. If you ask a complicated question with three or four multiple parts, then you look at, okay, of those three or four different things, I'll grab the weakest link in the chain, respond to that, and ignore the tougher parts of the question. So asking questions that are...
That's an art form, too.
Simple and understandable, and also being ready for the follow-up, because politicians are good, again, on both sides, at working to dodge questions or look at ways to go off on a tangent.
Yeah, I've always found in my personal interviews as a print reporter, it would take three runs at it. Usually the third answer is the best.
Absolutely. But again, that's part of the polish thing. And obviously Joe Biden, going back to 1972, is used to asking political questions. And people forget Donald Trump, when he did his first big debate in Cleveland in 2016, the Republican primary. A lot of people were surprised that he did so well.
But he had so much reality TV training.
Well, it's partly reality TV, but the actual reason goes back to when he was much younger. He did a lot of neighborhood zoning meetings on different real estate projects he was doing. So he got very good and understood the trick of listen to people attack you, say how terrible you are, and then you don't answer every question, every attack. You find out, again, the weakest link. You go after that, and they kind of forget the other more substantive questions. So he had a lot of experience, and that's why if you're debating a lot of business people. I can think of some people in the past that aren't experienced as trial lawyers, politicians, school teachers. They get into the political environment, and it's a hard thing to navigate.
Yeah, I think so, because you don't appreciate all the cross-training. And because Trump did understand how to present himself on television, which some people just don't know how to do. It's not something you know the first time you get behind a camera.
And good or bad, people, particularly those younger, have shorter attention spans, and people don't always want to hear the two-minute answer. They want to hear the quick yes or no, or they want to hear something that attacks and feeds the base, so to speak.
So you prepped Josh Mandel for his debate against Sherrod Brown. Sherrod Brown is up again this year. How would you prep Bernie Moreno if you were getting him ready?
Well, part of it, we'll see what happens if there's debates, because things are a little up in the air, just like happened at the national level, where the so-called commission has been pushed to the sidelines. There's an Ohio debate commission.
Also been pushed to the sidelines.
Right, right. And there's different reasons for that. That's a whole other discussion.
Yeah.
But there's obviously some TV stations, some other people would like to sponsor some debates. But a lot of it, how you prepare, depends on what's the format and who's moderating and where they're likely to go. And some of the moderators, I remember in the first Strickland-Kasich debate, Laura Bischoff, was kind of the den mother, the ringleader, preparing the other panelists, and she runs a tight ship and gets people properly prepared. Colleen Marshall on Channel 4 is very good at that. Obviously, Mike Thompson is. But you look at who's moderating and what kind of issues they're most interested in personally, because that might give you a tip off of where they'll go and what slant they'll put on things.
Brown is pretty good, though, at doing the I connect to the common man. Like, he has a little bit of that. I don't know if you remember the Bill Clinton debate where he actually got off the stage and walked down to the woman and looked at her eye to eye.
Well, there's different things that happen. Remember, at the state level, another factor, and one of the problems the Ohio Debate Commission had, is they promised to get a lot of coverage, but then they had a debate in Marietta for governor, and virtually nobody in the TV stations covered it in Ohio. So,
I mean, Marietta was a haul.
Absolutely. It was nice to think about that part of the state, but in preparing for a debate, part of it is what kind of audience is going to have. And obviously this one tonight, there was a question, is it just going to be on CNN? And then the other networks are covering it, but then CNN has its rules of how many times you got to mention CNN's name, and you can't do this and you can't do that. So where it's being had and the audience, but again, the number one rule in debates, don't make gaffes or goofs, because those are the things that get played back against you, potentially in commercials.
And speaking of where you can watch tonight, you can watch the debate on WOSU Public Media. You can watch it on WOSU TV or WOSU.org, or right here, you can listen on 89.7 NPR News, followed by our own NPR analysis. We'll also have complete coverage tomorrow morning on Morning Edition. So I want to talk a little bit about tonight's matchup. How high do you think the stakes are for both candidates?
They're really high. But the good news is there's a lot of time, because that's always one of the debates about debates, is when do you have them?
This is crazy early.
Totally. But in some ways that might be good or bad, because if you either one doesn't do as well, you've got a lot of time to recover. Also, I know from your earlier program segment, I think he made the point that a lot of voters are baked in and locked in of exactly where they're at. And a lot of times there are undecided voters, but sometimes undecided voters become voters who say, I hate both of them. I can't decide. I don't want to make a mistake, so I won't vote. So
that's the real question for me this election cycle. Politico described it as, we're going to hate watch the debate.
Well, and there's people that love to hate either candidate.
Oh, yeah.
And they want to tune in just to see, I told you so-and-so was really bad.
Yeah, we'll have to see how it goes. My final question is, do you have a Sherrod Brown impersonation? Do you have a Ted Strickland impersonation?
Not really, because you don't really try and imitate their accent or whatever. It's more knowing about some of the attacks they're going to come from on healthcare, on taxes, or other kind of things, so that it's about the issues they, and of course, governor is, or even a senator, is much different than president, because president, particularly at these volatile times of the economy, the international, the other issues, there's such a wide range of issues. Mm. And people are going to be looking to see CNN, because both those moderators have been very nasty in their attacks on Trump in the past. Can they play it down the middle? How do they balance out what questions they're asking? What things do they do probes on? And do they try and play fact checker?
That was Republican strategist and former debate stand-in Terry Casey. Thank you so much for your time this morning.
Thank you.
And thank you all for listening to All Sides on 89.7 NPR News.